Thank you, Mr. Fauché, for that special music. Enjoyed that very much. And good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I have not been in Houston South since COG was started. It's been many years ago, last time I was in Houston South. And anyway, it's a pleasure to be back once again. I look around and I see a lot of friends that we've had memories from years gone by. And having grown up here in the Houston area, it's very nice to return home. I always feel that way whenever I come back and see brethren that have remained faithful through the years. It's a real pick-me-up, shot in the arm, very encouraging. So nice to be here with you today. The mention of anniversaries, I suppose I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that yesterday was Teddy's and my 43rd anniversary. So anyway, we're hanging in there. We haven't reached 69, but God willing, we're shooting for that, and as many as God will give us. But anyway, marriage certainly is a wonderful blessing, and we're very thankful and very appreciative. And of course, now we're at the age where Mr. Herrick will soon have maybe this hair, kind of color hair, and maybe he'll have grandchildren as we do, and it's a different stage of life, getting to enjoy your grandchildren and their cute sayings and things that they do. I should bring you greetings, and I do bring you greetings from the brethren in Austin. We have probably about a similar size congregation as you have here, and very nice. Our congregation in Austin happens to have a lot of young children, and so pretty vibrant with the things going on. We had a senior function, and I think we had 12 people present. So anyway, you see the demographics, sort of the way they're skewed, and I always thought of myself as one of the young people, so that was an awakening as to where things are. But anyway, we have a pretty active congregation there, and Teddy and I are enjoying being there and serving the brethren in Austin. Just a few things that I can tell you about that I'm involved in. The Feast of Tabernacles in New Braunfels is coming along. A lot of chatter via internet and email and phone calls right now as department heads are finalizing details with the various activities and things that are going to take place. I know some of you will be attending New Braunfels, no doubt. And registration for New Braunfels this year is just over 300. That's down a bit from last year when we had about 400 at New Braunfels, but that's typical for a lot of feast sites this year because we have so many Americans transferring. British Columbia, our site there in Victoria, is taking 500 or 600 of about the 1,000 U.S. members that are going internationally this year. So that affected some of the other mainland U.S. Feast sites that we've had. The other thing that is happening, we are continuing to be involved with editorial projects and things that are happening. Monday, there will be a planning meeting for the January-February issue of Discern Magazine up at the COGWA office. I plan to drive up for that and be present as I usually am and try to be for those planning sessions. And basically what we do, the staff sits in the conference room and we have a cover theme idea in mind, but then we brainstorm for accompanying articles. And we have article assignments and obviously deadlines for writing that are handed out. And your prayers for our continued God's continued guidance and blessing in terms of our editorial efforts would be appreciated. And of course, for the coming year, we're already looking ahead to 2017. We need to come up with two more booklets is our plan. We try to produce two booklets a year. And so there are a couple of those that we have in mind that we're considering. We haven't finalized that this year, as many of you know. We had a couple of booklets already in the pipeline, including the one that the United States and Britain and the Commonwealth in prophecy. And that was a major booklet that we are very pleased to have completed. And so we hope to have one booklet to be able next year to release again at the spring, and another before the fall holy days. So those are some of the things that are happening there. As I begin my sermon here this afternoon, I'd like for you to put yourself in the shoes of a church pastor. Consider that you've been a church pastor and you're nearing the end of a long and faithful career, having served your congregation, and you've taught people God's wonderful truths, and now at this stage of your life, you receive a vivid vision from God, and your congregation happens to be in this vision that you receive. And sadly, you learn, or hear, and see in this vision that the congregation you pastored had not taken to heart one of the central issues that you had repeated over and over again. In fact, people probably talked about you and said, well, there's that pastor again. I already know what he's going to talk about. He had a reputation for this one subject that he talked about over and over and over again, especially toward the end of his life as he grew older. And yet it seems as though people must not have heard. This man, this pastor, had a zeal for Christ that in his younger years earned him and another zealous apostle named James the nickname Sons of Thunder. You could read about this in Mark chapter 3 and verse 17. That passage tells us that Christ gave them this particular name. And technically, that name is a combination of the Boanerges, or Boanerges is what it is a combination of two Hebrew words signifying sons of thunder. Some believe this came from an incident recorded for us in Luke's account, where these two apostles asked Christ if he wanted them to call down fire on a Samaritan village. Well, in this apostle's later years, he became known as the Apostle of Love. And in case you haven't figured it out yet, I'm speaking of the Apostle John and the vision he recorded in the book of Revelation. The vision that John received about Ephesus is the one in particular that I'm speaking of, because history tells us that John was the pastor of that ancient city. Teddy and I had the opportunity a few years back to visit Ephesus on one of the Feast of Tabernacles tours that we took on the seven churches of Revelation. And that city was there, and history tells us that that's where he pastored. And so in the book of Revelation, when John received the messages to the seven churches, the very first message was written to Ephesus, and it was written to this congregation that he had pastored. And as having served this congregation so many years, it must have been an especially poignant message and vision that he received, and it was probably a bit disappointing. You know, if we examine the section here in Revelation chapter 2, verses 1 through 7, we could look at a lot of the details that are involved in this particular section, but I'm not going to do that today. We have a series of articles, including one on the churches of Revelation, including one specifically on Ephesus on our Life, Hope, and Truth website. But if we look in this particular section of Scripture in verses 1 through 7, there are a couple of things that we can see pretty obviously. For example, in verse 2, where John is told to write down to this particular church that Christ says, I know your works, your labor, your patience, and that you cannot bear those who are evil, and you've tested those who say they are apostles and are not, and have found them liars. So they were able to remain true to doctrine. That wasn't their problem or difficulty. And it seems that this was an especially important compliment in the end of the first century, because doctrine was being watered down at that particular time, and there were people, as Jude says, that had crept in unawares, and they were turning the grace of God into licentiousness, an excuse for compromising and disobeying God's law. And so they had held fast, apparently, to those teachings that Christ had given. Continuing verse 3, you've persevered and have patience, have labored for my name's sake, and have not become weary. And so they remained strong in many ways. There's a great compliment or two to be found in that particular section. But verse 4 says, nevertheless, I have this against you, that you've left your first love. Remember, therefore, from where you've fallen, repent and do the first works, or else I'll come to you quickly and remove your lampstand from its place, unless you repent. And so in this particular case, they were doctrinally sound, but their love, their first love, they apparently had lost. And this was an important particular doctrine or particular teaching. God wasn't pleased about this. And so I ask the question today, what did John mean when he wrote first love? What was he talking about? How are we to understand that particular statement about not forgetting, or you've lost your first love, you've left that? I'd like to focus on this admonition to Ephesus and see how it applies to us today. After all, verse 7 of this particular section that's written to Ephesus tells us that these messages that were given to Ephesus were to be listened to and heeded, and we're supposed to pay attention to what they say. Verse 7 says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And so this is a timeless message that is still important for us today. If you're taking notes and would like a title for my sermon today, it is Hold On to Your First Love. So let's examine this concept of love. As a writer myself, I'm always intrigued by words and particular choices of words that people may use. And I think there's much to be gained by examining a writer in terms of his background, what he's learned, what he has written himself, and what influences this particular person may have had as he was writing down this vision. Now, we do understand that the book of Revelation is actually a vision from God the Father that he gave to Jesus Christ, gave to an angel, gave to John. So in one sense, John is dictating. But John, in his mind's eye, has seen the vision, and John is putting it down in his words. And so the point that I'm making about John's experience, John's teaching, his choice of wording here is something that I'd like to examine as we answer this question and as we talk about this concept of hold on to your first love. There are some people that have suggested that what John was talking about when he said first love was the zeal that people have when they are first called, or perhaps for a second or third or multiple generation Christian, the commitment of mind at baptism that someone may have. Others have said it also referred to the love that brethren would have for each other. And what I'd like to point out is that actually all of these concepts, love of God, zeal for God's way of life, and love of brethren are included, I believe they are included, when John wrote this word, first love. And I'll try to make the case for you as we go through a few other scriptures to prove this point that I'm making. I did examine a number of commentaries, and I do have a couple of different ones that I tend to look at as I examine different passages and try to glean information from them. And sometimes you find really interesting material, background material, that helps explain a particular passage, and sometimes you come across real clinkers, explanations that you just know that can't be right. I'll tell you about a clinker that I came across here in this particular passage. This Bible study aid mistakenly said that this passage was one where the brethren were very good at searching out and rejecting heresy that was creeping into Christianity, but they lost their love for the brethren. And according to this mistaken commentator, This person said, this emphasis on doctrinal purity left them hard-hearted. In essence, he was suggesting that they had become nitpickers, and thus they didn't have warm relationships with others, and that maybe they should have compromised doctrine. And they shouldn't have been so nitpicking about doing what God said in the doctrinal issue. Well, that's a misguided idea. I hope you recognize that right from the outset. It's based on a faulty premise. The faulty premise is that it's impossible to have both sound doctrine and love for brethren. Actually, we can and should have both of these concepts. The two can go hand in hand, and God expects us, just as He did the congregation at Ephesus, to have both. So in essence, I've already given you the explanation of what it means to hold on to your first love, but now let me prove the point to you. To understand John's writing, we also, I believe, need to understand that John was a disciple of Christ and was personally taught by Christ. And so when Christ gave some instruction and teaching about holding fast to truth and loving people, that's the foundation that John had. So let's look at a few scriptures that talk about Christ's teaching on these subjects. The Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 is a great place for us to start. Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount, 5, 6, and 7, gives us many of the themes that Christ expounded in His ministry. And we can touch on just a couple of these. In verse 17, for example, Jesus said, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill." And so we see that Christ accepted God's law, and His teaching was to accept God's law. So we don't water down God's law. That's a fundamental premise. We also see in the last part of chapter 5, verses 43 and 44, Jesus said, "You've heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." So we see that Jesus also taught love, loving one another, and even loving one's enemies. He expounded and strengthened the concept about love. So law and love are both spoken of by Christ. And again, in Matthew chapter 7, verse 21, Jesus said, "Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but who does the will of my Father in heaven." And so the concept of being obedient to God's instruction and also having love are two concepts that are both included on the Sermon on the Mount. Well, let's go ahead to Matthew chapter 22. I think most of you realize the setting of this particular passage, where Jesus was often asked trap questions, where people were trying to get Him to say something that was incorrect or for some way that they might be able to arrest Him. And a lawyer came and asked Jesus a question, verse 35 of Matthew 22, testing Him. And so he was probing Jesus. In verse 36, he said, "Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law?" We're in Matthew 22 and now verse 37. And Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Now, if we think in terms of God, we almost see a pyramid in the sense that scriptures tell us that God is love. And then there are two great commandments, and both of these commandments that summarize God's whole way of life and expectations of us are also based on love. One is that we love God, and the second commandment is that we love our neighbor. And the scripture where Christ here says, "On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." You know, I think there's a disconnect perhaps for us sometimes to think in terms of what is doctrine and what is not doctrine. The reason I say this is because I assert to you that obeying God and loving one's neighbor, loving one another, are both doctrinal issues. Doctrine simply has the meaning of teaching or instructing. And Jesus described this as a commandment. And so if we think in terms of two great commandments summarizing the whole way of life, one is that we love God, which means keeping God's laws, striving to obey the things that He asks us to do. And another is loving the brethren and loving our neighbors, being a good citizen, being a good neighbor, treating people respectfully and kindly. Jesus said this was the second great commandment. And it's not a matter that Jesus tells us, you know, it's pick one out of two, your choice. It's an expectation that we do both of these. And so the way we act around others, the way we treat people, is a commandment, is the point that I'm making. It is a doctrinal teaching. It is something that is not just a nice thing to do. It's very important to do. And so we love God by doing what God tells us to do. And we also love our neighbors by treating them respectfully. And so love is a foundational teaching. And in your mind's eye, put John sitting there at the feet of Christ along with the other disciples as Christ is doing this teaching. So this has been part of what's been going into John's mind as he's thinking about this subject of love. Christ, this is the teaching that he has received. And then if we go over to John chapter 13, John, of course, is one of the gospel accounts, and John wrote his gospel accounts a little bit different than the other three, the first three gospel accounts that are called the synoptic gospels, meaning they see things from a similar perspective. But John wrote more about Jesus being the Messiah. And in John chapter 13, in verses 34 through 35, we see a statement that Christ made and John recorded that was only recorded by John. Wasn't recorded by Matthew, Mark, or Luke. And in verse 34 of John chapter 13, we read John quoting Jesus. "A new commandment," Jesus said, "I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." And so the importance of love was written about by John. He recorded this of Jesus' teaching about how important this was. This new commandment, if some of you have studied into this, you know that to love your neighbor as yourself was actually an instruction that was given in the Old Testament. And so this idea of loving your neighbor as yourself was not new. But what made this a new commandment was the phrase here that Jesus said, that you love one another as I have loved you. Jesus elevated love and the way that it is expressed to others in a way that had not been done before. So there was an emphasis here. This is what made it a new commandment, was the level of love that was involved. And by the way, we have an article on this on Life Open Truth website as well, if you'd like to study about more about this new commandment and what it means being a new commandment. And so John heard Christ speak these words. And then if we come down just over a chapter to John chapter 14 and verse 15, John quotes Jesus as saying, "If you love me, keep my commandments." And then in verse 21, "He who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest," meaning reveal myself, make myself understood, seen, comprehended by myself to him. And verse 24, he who does not love me does not keep my words, and the word which you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me. And so John is recording this principle that keeping the commandments, obeying God, is how we love God. Chapter 15, this section, of course, these are Christ's words before he was crucified. This was the evening after this final Passover, so Jesus was expressing many of these thoughts that he wanted to leave with his disciples. And John is the one that recorded these words and teachings of Christ for us. Verse 9 of John 15, Jesus said, "As the Father loved me, I've also loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you'll abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love." And verses 12 and 13, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I've loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for his friends." And we certainly know that Christ did this. Verse 17 repeats it. "These things I command you, that you love one another." And verse 19, "If you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you." So obedience to God and love of him and the brethren are all wrapped up together in this kind of love that Jesus taught. And these concepts are the foundation of our relationship with God. We don't separate them out. They're all included, and they work together. There's another incident in John chapter 21, in verse 15 through 17, and it's an account that after Christ was crucified and resurrected and spent 40 days appearing to his disciples, there was an incident where the disciples had gone fishing and they hadn't caught any fish, and Christ came to them early in the morning. And if you're a fisherman, you know the story that they caught this big net of fish, how many that they caught. And John, again, is the only gospel writer to give us details about this particular incident. But verses 15 through 17, we read, "So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, 'Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?' And he said to him, 'Yes, Lord, you know that I love you.' And he said, 'Feed my lambs.' And he said to him a second time, 'Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?' And he said to him, 'Yes, Lord, you know that I love you.' And he said to him, 'Tend my sheep.' And he said to him a third time, 'Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?' And Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, 'Do you love me?' And he said, 'Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you.' And Jesus said to him, 'Feed my sheep.'" Now we look at this passage sometimes from a number of different ways, and we see the importance of that Christ was making to Simon Peter, and perhaps the three times was in reference to Peter denying him three times. But there's also an aspect here about love, and that Jesus was saying one of the ways that a minister could love Christ would be to faithfully feed the sheep that he had care of. And so John saw this particular incident. And so I think John was being groomed in a certain way to understand the subject of love. These were the teaching moments that John had. These moments were in John's mind as he was reflecting on this particular subject, and probably as he taught the brethren. Well, let's go on just a little bit, because there were other New Testament writers that spoke on the subject of love, and I'd like to touch on these just a little bit as well. Paul was a major writer of the New Testament, a very large number of books in the New Testament, and most of us are familiar with 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We just call it the love chapter. And it really is a very fundamental passage on the subject of love. We have called it within the Church of God the love chapter with good reason, because it explains in very practical ways what love looks like and what love is supposed to be. We often say that love is not just an emotion, but love is a choice that we make that causes us to do certain things. And if we look here at 1 Corinthians chapter 13, beginning in verse 1, we read about this teaching. Paul wrote, "Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains but have not love, I'm nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned but have not love, it profits me nothing." And then he says, "Love suffers." And he says, "Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails." You know, it's interesting to me on several levels, the fact that for many of us, we probably have a mental image of Paul as being somewhat of an austere, controversial figure who wasn't afraid to speak against authorities and get himself into trouble. An extrovert that just couldn't help himself, and no wonder he was stoned and beaten so many different times. We probably suspect that was his nature, and we may think of him more of that kind of individual and may not see a soft side to the Apostle Paul. And yet here, Paul is able to write an explanation of what the subject of love is really like. And interestingly enough, of all places for us to find it in the Bible, the book of 1 Corinthians is perhaps one of the most corrective books we have in the entire New Testament. This congregation had problems and had difficulties, and Paul had to speak strongly to them and give them correction. And yet at the same time that he did this, he was able to teach them and explain what love looked like and how love should be practiced. And then there's something else when we come to 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verses 1 through 8. Most of us are familiar with 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where there was a man involved in sexual immorality and he needed to be put out of the church. And Paul had written 1 Corinthians about that. But some time has passed. And now let's pick up 2 Corinthians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Paul writes, "But I determined this within myself, that I would not come again to you in sorrow. For if I make you sorrowful, then who is he who makes me glad but the one who is made sorrowful by me?" Kind of a rhetorical question. Paul had a perspective and an intelligence, a way of thinking that made sense as he was writing it. "And I wrote this very thing to you, lest when I came, I should have sorrow over those from whom I ought to have joy, having confidence in you all that my joy is the joy of you all." Paul is putting feelers out here, wondering how he perhaps is being perceived by the brethren and how he will be received if he returns. "For out of much affliction and anguish of heart I wrote to you with many tears, not that you should be grieved, but that you might know the love which I have so abundantly for you." Paul wants the members there to know that he cares for them. He's not just some dictator from on high telling them what to do. "But if anyone has caused grief, he's not grieved me, but all of you to some extent, not to be too severe. This punishment, which was inflicted by the majority, is sufficient for such a man, so that on the contrary you ought rather to forgive and comfort him, lest perhaps such a one be swallowed up with too much sorrow. Therefore, I urge you to reaffirm your love to him." Most scholars believe that this section of Scripture is a reference back to 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And the assumption in this particular passage is that the man repented, that he changed from what he was doing, rectified the situation, and now Paul is concerned that he be accepted back by the brethren. He was concerned for this individual. He had a love and a care for him. We see a tender side of Paul and his ministry. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, let me just give you a couple of scriptures. I'm not going to turn to these, but they help add to the picture of what Paul taught. 1 Thessalonians 4:9, he said, "Concerning brotherly love, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another." He said that to the Thessalonians. To the Galatians in chapter 6 and verse 2, he said, "Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ." And so we see that Paul's teaching was consistent with the other congregations that he served as well. But let's turn now to Ephesians chapter 4. This, interestingly enough, is the book that Paul wrote to the congregation that John later apparently pastored, is what history tells us. And even this particular instruction in the book of Ephesians, chapter 4, in verse 16, and this is what I'd like to focus on. And the context of this, of course, is in verse 11, where we see that Paul wrote that Christ gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, pastors, and teachers for the good of the church so that it would grow. Verse 14, that people would not be tossed to and fro, carried about with every wind of doctrine. Verse 15, but speaking the truth in love may grow up in all things into him who is the head, Christ. And so even the teaching and instruction of the church was to be done in love. And then verse 16, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working, by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. To edify means to build up, to nourish, to encourage, to inspire. And so one of the things we see in a healthy relationship here in the structure that Christ gave for the church is that they're to be teachers, they're to be instructors, to teach people God's way. And there's also the body itself has the responsibility of living together in harmony. So we inspire each other. We edify one another. And that's done by the love that we have for each other. So there's a healthy environment for the church of God. It includes doctrinal truth, and it includes the love of the brethren. The two go hand in hand and work together is the instruction that is being given here. Chapter 5 continues on, and sometimes we jump to chapter 5 when we are talking about marriage, and there's nothing wrong with us doing that. Because there is instruction about marriage, but sometimes I don't think we take the teaching in Ephesians chapter 5 back to what we read in Ephesians chapter 4 of how Christ first established the church. There's interesting wording in Ephesians 5 verse 1, therefore. When we read the word therefore, it means we conclude something because of something else we've seen earlier. And so Paul is making a transition here from the instruction and the teaching that came before. And part of that, I submit to you, is how the church is nourished and edified in love. He says, therefore, be followers of God as dear children, verse 2, and walk in love, as Christ has also loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. And then coming down in this particular section, we see instruction to wives. In verse 25, we see husbands are to love their wives. And so what we see the church, the instruction that is given, how it is edified in love, and then Paul transitions from that in the love that is supposed to be in a marriage and how husbands and wives treat one another. It's a continuation of the foundation of the church itself, the way it is to be organized and to operate. In Colossians chapter 3, I won't spend a lot of time here in this particular section, but let's go to Colossians chapter 3 and verses 13 through 14. Some instruction to the church here at Colossae. Colossians 3, verse 13. Bearing with one another, forgiving one another, if anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. The point I'm trying to make here is that Paul also did quite a bit of teaching about the subject of love. To Timothy, he wrote in 2 Timothy 1:7, he said, the Holy Spirit is a spirit of power and love and a sound mind. And we find in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 10 that Timothy followed Paul's example of love for God and for the brethren. Let me take the time to turn to that particular passage, 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 10. Paul, writing to him, says, but you've carefully followed my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, love, perseverance, many things on this list of things that had done. And one of the things Paul was commending Timothy for was the fact that it was not only the doctrine, but it was also the love that he had for the brethren and for God's way of life. You know, it's easy for us just to read over verses such as this without sometimes focusing on a particular subject. And I'm giving you a number of passages today, and sometimes that gets tedious, I realize, in doing this. But I've also found, at least from my own perspective, when I look at a particular subject and I see the volume of material and the breadth, the variety of a particular subject, I get a fuller and more complete picture of the teaching of what is being given. And I'm trying to give you a sample of that today in terms of going through this number of scriptures. Let me give you one more from Paul's teaching, and then we'll move on. Let's go to Titus, just next door in my Bible here across the page, but we'll actually go to Titus chapter 2, verses 2 through 4. Titus chapter 2, let's begin in verse 1. Titus chapter 2, verse 1. But as for you, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine, Paul wrote to Titus. And what is sound doctrine? That the older men may be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, in patience. Older men are supposed to operate in a loving and a kind way. Sometimes it's easier for older guys to think in terms of, I'm wiser, I've had more experience doing this, and I can share doing that. And we may focus, which are good things to do, we may focus on that, and we may just read right over the aspect that love is something that has to be taught as well and should be taught to the younger men in the congregation and to others. Verse 3, the older women, likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children. to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. Kind of interesting that Paul wrote to Titus to teach the older men and the older women to both be examples and teachers of love to the younger generation. Sometimes we don't always think about that part of the teaching or the instruction that we've been given. So anyway, now that we know that Paul is a warm, fuzzy guy, let's go on to another one of the disciples. Let's go to Peter, and we'll sample probably a few verses, not nearly as many. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 22. Peter writes to the brethren, "Since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit in sincere love of the brethren." Wow, what a statement. Both of the concepts, the two great commandments of Jesus Christ, loving God and loving one another, are encapsulated in this particular verse, in this phrase, by Peter. "Since you've purified your souls in obeying the truth," that's how we love God, "through the Spirit in sincere love of the brethren," that's the second great commandment, "love one another fervently with a pure heart." We do it genuinely. We don't do it with false motives or with wrong intent. And so Peter taught this important principle. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 17, very short, pithy statements here. Peter writes, "Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." Love the brotherhood. Love the brethren. Care for them. Be involved with them. Show them that you care. Well, now that we've seen and sampled Christ's teaching, Paul's teaching, a couple of verses of Peter's teaching, let's go to John, the general epistles, not the gospel, but let's go to 1 John chapter 3 and verse 1. We could probably read all of 1 John, all of 2 John, and all of 3 John, and we'll see that John so often talks about this subject of love that he had the reputation, as some commentaries would point out, that it seemed like every time he talked, he always had the same subject in mind. Of course, some of you old-timers may realize that some people said that about Mr. Herbert Armstrong, that he was always talking about the two trees. That was always something that was important for us to understand, and it was important. John was focused on this concept of loving God and loving our brother and our sister and brethren. And John seemed to gravitate to this particular instruction that came from Christ. So let's sample. As I said, we could read all of John's writings, but I've condensed this down into just a few concise passages where we can sample what John seemed to be repeating over and over again. John chapter 3, verse 1. "Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us, because it did not know Him." It's the love of God that has called us to this way of life. Verse 10 and 11. "In this the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother." Again, the two principles, the two great commandments. "For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another." And he goes on, verse 12, to tie it all the way back to Cain, that this concept of loving one another is actually old. Christ called it new when he raised the level of love to the way that he loved others. Verse 14. "We know that we pass from death to life because we love the brethren. He who does not love his brother abides in death." Verse 16, "By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. 1 John 4, verse 7. John continues the same theme. 1 John 4, verse 7. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He expounded on this concept of love being part of who we are and why it should permeate our lives. Verse 11, but if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. And then verses 19 through 21, we love him because he first loved us. If someone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he's a liar. Or he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he's not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. John keeps adding it up, upping the ante, explaining just how vital and how critical it is that we do this. One more sampling and we'll move on. 1 John chapter 5 and verses 2 through 3. By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. So John expounded this particular concept. And so what a sad situation it was for him to hear that the congregation that history tells us that he pastored had lost their first love, that they needed to return to that. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us whether the brethren in Ephesus heeded the instruction that they were given, whether they recaptured their first love or not. I'd like to think that they did, and that the Apostle John died with the comfort that those that he had taught had responded to the message and the teaching, and that the vision that he'd received had awakened them to the need to respond in such a way. Of course, what is most important for us is not what the church members in Ephesus did. We care about them. We're concerned about that. But what's most important for us today is what we're going to do with this timeless message from Christ. This message is relevant for us today. Back in the Olivet Prophecy in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 12, Jesus Christ said that this concept, the love of many, is going to grow cold. It's going to diminish as we come to the end of this age. Notice Matthew, as I said, chapter 24 and verse 12. Jesus said, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Lawlessness or disobedience to God and God's way of life will cause our love to diminish as we see our society around us become ever more lawless, ever more opposed to God, ever more rejecting biblical truths and God's way of life. There's going to be a hardening, a selfishness that will increase. Paul prophesied of this precise result in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verses 1 through 3. There's a description of what things are going to be like in the end of this age. Pardon me. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verses 1 through 3. Paul said, but know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving. There's that word, unloving. Unforgiving, slanderers without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And so the end of the age, there's going to be more and more of that around us. As members of God's church, we're going to have to resist what we see around us. We've always had to do that. But as society becomes worse and these attitudes become stronger, we will have to resist even more. If we're not careful, these things can creep into our way of thinking. And we can think of them as being normal or natural or just the way that everybody is. We have to make a conscious effort that we're not going to let the world's way affect us. How do we hold on to the love of God and the love of our brethren? 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 14. I'll begin wrapping this up here. Let's go to 2 Timothy 3 and verse 14. Paul simply said, 2 Timothy 3 and verse 14, "But as for you, continue in the things which you have learned and been assured of, knowing from whom you have learned them." Paul, we read earlier, had taught the importance of obedience to God as well as love of the brethren. And so we have to continue in what we've been taught. And then I'll leave you with one last passage in Hebrews chapter 10 and verses 23 through 25. Some of you know already this particular passage. It's a very familiar one to us. And we sometimes turn to this particular passage to talk about the assembling of ourselves together and how important it is. And it's a great verse and a great passage for that purpose. But I'd like to focus a little bit differently here as I wrap up. Let's read it in verse 23 of Hebrews chapter 10. The writer here of this book says, "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. He who promised is faithful. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching." As we come to the day of Christ's return, one of the reasons that we assemble together is because, as verse 24 tells us, is to stir up love and good works. We encourage one another. We love one another. We help one another as we obey God and as we encourage each other in living this way of life. The older I've gotten, the more I've come to understand and appreciate John's teaching on this subject of love. It's not that I didn't agree with it before. I did. But through the years, I've come to see in my experiences that I've had of working with God's people, having the privilege of serving and teaching in many different ways, that I've seen when this aspect of love is not practiced, I've seen just how devastating it can be, how hard it can be on a congregation, how hard it can be on individuals. We never compromise doctrine. We never compromise God's way of life, His teaching, and His instruction. But along with holding fast to what God teaches, I hope we all can appreciate the importance of loving one another. And so when John wrote down in his vision that we have to maintain this first love that we have, this first love has to do with obeying God and loving one another. Both components are important. Let's hold on to our first love.